Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Today, it's my pleasure to introduce our next speaker in the series, Dr. Jeff Ritterman. He's a practicing cardiologist in the Richmond community. He's originally from Brooklyn, New York, and has had a long-standing commitment to social justice and environmental justice issues. He completed his medical training in Philadelphia and his cardiology fellowship at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's on the steering committee for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter for Physicians for Social Responsibility, on the board of the Public Health, the Public and Environmental Health Advisory Board, which advises Contra Costa Health Services and Board of Supervisors, and on the advisory board for the Center for Health in North Richmond. Dr. Ritterman was also co-founder of the Committee for Health Rights in Central America, the Salvadoran Medical Relief Fund, and the South African Medical Aid Fund. He's personally delivered medical supplies to Salvadoran refugees living in camps in Honduras and Costa Rica during the war in El Salvador in the 1980s. He's also delivered medical supplies to the African National Congress Clinic in Zambia prior to the end of apartheid. Really, for the past 25 years, he's worked on many, many issues and really has put a human face to many of the tragedies that have affected the globe. He also was recently elected to the City Council of Richmond just last week. And today he's really here to speak to us in the next step in our series on human rights in the age of environmental devastation and climate chaos.
Hi, everybody. First, you know, it's really an honor to come here and get to share my thoughts and my ideas with you. And a lot of you are a lot younger than I am, and you're going to be the leaders in a lot of fields and healthcare fields in the future. And I just really cherish the opportunity to maybe open your eyes to different ways of seeing things than you've looked at them before. And I hope to learn some things from you as well. When they asked me to come and speak to this mini-series, they gave me a few choices, and one was to talk about human rights and the war in Iraq, and then my friend Bob Gould sort of talked all about that. So they gave me this environmental topic, which I hadn't really spoken about before, although I do a lot of work in environmental health. And I found it a really interesting topic to think about human rights and how they have evolved over time and where we are now in the planetary situation of such real challenges for us. I think right now we're facing the twin challenges of economic collapse and ecological collapse at the same time. I don't think any generation of people on this planet has ever had to deal with that. So I'm really here to organize you to be activists in your own way, to figure out how best to meet these challenges. I've heard it said that if we're not careful, we just might end up where we're headed. And that doesn't look like a very good, very attractive place to me. So let's start our discussion, our thought, by going back a little and to something we all learned growing up. After all, one of the foundations of modern human rights is our own Declaration of Independence. And we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And a whole group of people could say that unself-consciously, even though they were aware they were excluding people who didn't own property, women, some of them even owned slaves at the time. So, but yet this marked a huge advance in human thinking beyond the divine right of kings, because now you didn't have to be a king. You could be a rich white guy and be part of the club. So that that was somewhat of an advance. And now, with us looking back, it's remarkable to think that Thomas Jefferson could have owned slaves, or George Washington, or Jefferson could have fathered children with his slaves. And yet these were the architects of an enlightened way of thinking at that time. You'll notice that in the sort of modern history of human rights, as we start, it's all about us, humans, right? It's mainly about protecting us from each other, making sure that we treat each other right. Because the next great jump in human rights thought was really after the Second World War, and that's what brought us the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And why did that come? That came because we were so shocked by what we had done to each other in the Second World War that we had actually institutionalized death and death camps, something that really had never happened before. So in our collective revulsion, the United Nations came into being, and due a lot to the work of Eleanor Roosevelt, we got the UN Declaration of Human Rights. But it's, again, in a human-centric kind of universe, we haven't yet come up against the limits of the natural world, limits which now we in our generation, in our time, in this time, have to deal with so seriously. And the UN has gone on to make lots of different committees and statements about human rights, and I won't read them all to you, but there, you know, here's political, economic, cultural rights. It's being expanded. But again, this is coming during my lifetime, 1966. I was born in 1948. So this is really an advance, but again, it's human-centric. It's how can we make sure that we extend the rights to basically life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to other human beings on the planet, and make sure that tyrants don't prevent that. Another statement about human rights. But we kind of begin to move off that here. Here's a statement, United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, 2002. The human right to water is indispensable for leading a life in human dignity. So we haven't quite here gotten to the point where we're thinking about the rights of our relatives like the polar bear. But we are noticing that not only are we interdependent in terms of how we treat each other as human beings, but we live in a biosphere that when it's violated, it's virtually impossible to talk about human rights in any substantial way that makes any sense. And here we're beginning to see the change in our way of thinking. You know, sometimes we forget that we change. In my lifetime, our attitude toward cigarette smoking has totally changed, for example. Or when I was a boy, it wasn't unusual to see women wearing coats that were made from the furs of all kinds of different animals. But the women who have those coats now keep them in their closets, because it's a little intimidating to go out, because there's a different consciousness. And so what is the consciousness that we need to develop and need to mold to meet the challenges of our time? So here in our leaders who are thinking of human rights, we're beginning to address this right, this human need for water. But how about the right for our children to experience diversity in the natural world and all that would mean, for example? So some have begun to raise those questions and begun to talk about environmental rights or planetary rights. Polly Higgins is a barrister from UK who stopped her usual practice and began thinking of herself as a lawyer for the environment. And here she makes the point, just what I said before, it was from the horror of World War II that we began to seriously concentrate on human rights and develop our consciousness. Now with the planet in crisis, we need to do something further. We need to extend this further. We need a universal declaration of planetary rights. So we're going to step back a little now and just talk about, well, what is this planetary crisis that we're in the middle of? What does it look like? And then we'll come back a little to how does that shape our thinking for the future and our conceptions of human rights. So I just wanted to concentrate on a few issues in our environment. I thought, what's more humble than the frog? So if we're talking about preserving diversity and we're trying to understand our place in the planet, what can we learn from this humble creature? And there's a wonderful professor and scientist across the bay, Tyrone Hayes, who says he's a guy who just loves frogs, and these are his slides, and I learned a lot about frogs from him. And I learned that atrazine, which used to be the country's most commonly used pesticide, turns male frogs into hermaphrodites. So this is a slide showing that, and we got a lot of medical people in here, so showing that this male frog has both ovaries and testes. Now, atrazine has blanketed our Midwest for many, many years, and it's universally found everywhere. So these male frogs, they're not very, very good producers of testosterone. They basically, just by living in the wild, because of the atrazine, they become feminized. They no longer have a normal male frog lifetime. And in the real world, where we use lots of pesticides mixed together, they do even worse. Well, we spray a lot of pesticides in this country, and most of it doesn't even stay on the land and do the job it's supposed to do. And it's in our drinking water. This is California drinking water. And I work on pesticide reduction in my county. We're just getting an integrated pest management specialist. When I started working in the county on public health, every month we were spraying the Head Start building for ants prophylactically. So there are preschool children going there. And so, again, remember our basic human rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We are poisoning our children, and we'll come back to that. And we are poisoning those people who are picking our food for us. And the poisons we're putting out there are causing serious disease, causing Parkinson's disease or non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. There's all kinds of associations now between pesticide use and acute poisoning and chronic poisoning. And these are pictures that children drew who lived in the village which was pesticide-free in Mexico. These are not the valley dwellers where the pesticides settle. Their children draw this. So any consideration of human rights becomes beside the point if there's not normal brain development. There is no way for us to enjoy our full human potential without the marvelous use of our brain, which is also what's got to get us out of the fix we're in now. we our creativity, our talents together are what we have to apply to change this baseline situation. Well, to talk about how bad it is, let's talk about entering life now and what is in your body to start. I mean, after all, you're innocent at birth. You haven't picked up any bad habits yet. And yet, your little body is a storage depot for all kinds of things we're producing in this society. So this is a study by the Environmental Working Group where they took cord blood and they studied it. Well, what do you think is in the cord blood of a child born today? Pesticides, consumer products, waste from burning coal, gasoline, and garbage. So this is being stored when you start your life in your cells now. Now, this wasn't true for me. I mean, I'm born before really the onset of the huge use in pesticides. But any child born today, this is the legacy that we have given them. Let's look at it a little more closely. What's in there? What's in there is stuff that causes cancer, stuff that's toxic to brain development, and stuff that causes birth defects. DDT, for example, which is found in the cord blood, was banned in this country in the 1970s. So another lesson for us. Bad things we do, they last a long time. So whatever we do now that's bad, it's going to haunt those who come after us. So chemical banned in, I think it was 75, could have been 72, is in the cord blood of children born today. You know, there's a certain amount of mercury in the bay, just to dwell a little bit on this point of what we do today haunts us later. You know, the mercury in the bay is there mainly from the gold rush, because mercury was used in the processing of the gold. So that's why there's a lot of mercury poisoning in the fish. So that's the old story of where the mercury came from in the bay. Every year there is mercury from the ambient air that deposits in the bay. You know where it comes from? So they're burning, if you forget that it's a small planet, remember that, okay? The coal-fired plants, power plants in China, result in mercury being deposited in the San Francisco Bay. It also changes our weather. So let's get back to our newborn, okay? So this is what's accumulating in the newborn. Mercury is another thing, okay, that we find in the newborn. Mercury is toxic. Where I live in Contra Costa County, we have to put out a fish advisory so that our Laotian communities and other communities that are subsistence fisher people know that particularly if a woman is pregnant, that they can only have, you know, two servings a month. Okay, so it's sort of obvious that if you throw enough poison around, eventually you poison yourself. And these are all the other things that the newborns, I don't even know these chemicals. Polyaromatic hydrocarbons, well, that one I know. But polybrominated are flame retardants. Think of the idea here that we had. So we would put our flame retardants on our infants' pajamas so that if somehow a fire happened, we would somehow save them. But instead what's happened is the chemicals are getting into their system and they're toxic. All that flame retardant is on all your furniture. When a fire actually happens, the furniture burns anyway. So when the fireman comes in there, he breathes in the brominated hydrocarbons that are now liberated by the fire. And there's a huge problem in firemen all over this country now with all kinds of occupational cancers that they haven't actually been able to track down, but it's for sure going to be related in part to the chemicals we're using. So I won't belabor the point too much, but look what's in our children. Fabric and carpet protectors, food wrap coatings, Teflon, furniture foam. So we start our life at the very beginning now with this terrible chemical legacy. 90,000 chemicals out there, most haven't been tested in any way. The combinations haven't been tested. So what does human rights mean in the context of the child who unfortunately doesn't have normal brain development because of that exposure? And if you look at the incidences of autism and other neurological illnesses in children, they're going way up. The debate is it real? Or are we just finding more? You know, what's it from? But it seems logical to me that when we're living in a chemical environment, that we're going to suffer the consequences of it. After all, these things are absorbed by our bodies. I just want to turn to a different kind of problem in our environment and a different problem with our thinking. Because, of course, with the children, the thinking was we didn't really plan ahead. We didn't really take a precautionary principle. We didn't really say, is this going to affect our children? Somebody just said, hey, this chemical is good. You know, it helps you get the grease off your hands, and I can, you know, it's marketable. And that was enough. Well, another kind of thinking and another kind of barrier we crossed, I think, is in genetically modified foods. I want to just dwell on this for a second. You know, nature puts in barriers that are not normally crossed. For example, in nature, it's impossible for a cow to get mad cow disease because a cow's a vegetarian. How can a cow get mad cow disease by eating the brain of another animal or the spinal cord of another animal? In nature, it can't. So there is a natural barrier for that disease being prevented in the natural world. It's only when we started to feed cows these, I think they call them renderings, I mean basically chopped up pieces of other animals, that we got into that problem. We crossed a barrier that isn't crossed in nature. Genetically modified food does that as well. If you talk to the proponents, they say, well, you know, we've always been doing animal husbandry and we've always been, you know, picking out the best seeds and crossing them and, you know, making pluots and so on. But that's a different technique than taking the gene from a trout and putting it in a tomato. There's no way that can happen in nature, right? So all of a sudden, we open up a kind of Pandora's box. We opened it up because we thought, well, we know what we're doing. We're surgeons. We're just going to cut this gene out. We know what it makes. It makes this one protein. We're going to put it in here. It'll make that one protein. And, you know, that's all we need to know. So pretty interesting technique. Pretty useful here. Here we took the one that makes it, the little bugs, the fireflies, light up at night. Well, somebody was able to splice that gene into the tobacco plant. Very helpful if you lose your cigarettes in the dark. They would glow and you could find them. But it's not really a surgical procedure. it's more like a military operation than a surgical operation, because the way that we really do it is with a gene gun, and it's shot haphazardly into a whole plate of cells, hoping that you will, in some, penetrate the nucleus, and in those that you penetrate the nucleus, you'll find a spot where it'll find a home. It can be in the middle of a gene, it can be anywhere. There is no precision to this technique. And let me just share with you how wrong our assumptions can be. So the first assumption was, okay, well, this gene is going to make one protein. Well, when we decoded, or, you know, had the Human Genome Project and we figure out how many genes there are, all of a sudden it became very clear there's a lot more proteins being made than there are genes. These genes are coding for multiple proteins. They're making lots of things. Here's the champion. The fruit fly can make over 38,000 proteins, one gene. So when you put that gene in there that makes the tobacco plant light up, there's other things being produced in there too that you don't know about unless you're measuring for it. And this is the story, and we don't have time to go into it, of the tryptophan poisonings that happened in the past and why tryptophan was taken off the market. It had everything to do with genetic engineering and nothing to do with tryptophan. Another assumption, you could just put a gene in there and it wouldn't cause any problems to genes living down the block. Well, we know that's not true now. It turns things on, it turns things off. Another assumption. See, this is the kind of hubris we've brought to the world and the kind of consciousness we need to correct. Another assumption was that genetically modified food, the genes would get denatured in your stomach, and so there'd be no chance that they would get absorbed. But we know that's not true, because when you go to people who have colostomies and you take out the bacteria from their colostomy that live in their gut, those bacteria already have the genes that are in the genetically modified food within them. Think about this possibility. One of the genes we use for genetically modified food is BT. It's a pesticide. It's a naturally occurring pesticide. It's in every kernel of the corn, everything, right? It's used in the corn. What happens if it gets in the bacteria in your intestines and then your intestines start producing BT? You could be your own pesticide production plant. And the story with BT is that, at least in the laboratory, it kills monarch butterfly larvae because they eat something from the thistles or something from the corn plant. So, again, the hubris. Where's the thinking of how's this going to affect all of nature? Okay. So now you're seeing that the old thinking of human rights, what's in it for me, how do I make sure I don't get tortured and my friends don't get tortured? Now all of a sudden we're living in such a complicated world and we're causing so much harm in the very biosphere that supports all life that we have to evolve a different way of thinking about rights that, one, will allow those who come in the future to have some sort of life, and two, that'll preserve really the biological inheritance of the planet for people to enjoy. So let's turn to what some have called our way of harvesting our food. But let's just turn to this last environmental question that I'm going to talk about. And this is really the question of the future. And this is, so what do we owe those who come after us? Can we just keep the party going and party on and use up all the oil and all use energy in this way and consume in this way and not allow those to come after have a livable earth. And so what kind of rights do we have to talk about now? Now we have to talk about future rights. And that's both a new concept and an old concept. Some of you may go to the health food store and buy toilet paper or paper towels made by a company called Seventh Generation. Do you know where the name comes from? Any of you? That's from the Iroquois Confederacy. Their belief was that if they made a decision that would impact the entire society, that it should be a decision that would still be a good decision seven generations later. Now, I live in Richmond. We're dealing with a corporation, Chevron. They can't make a decision that doesn't impact on the next quarter. That's how we think, right? How much profit's going to be next quarter? What's the stock market going to do tomorrow? But the Iroquois Confederacy, they said, well, if we're going to make a decision, this has to be good for seven generations hence. And now we're on the threshold of changing the world in such a way that in several generations hence, they're not going to be able to enjoy life like we know it. And we live in total denial of this. And one of the even those of us who think we know about climate change pretty much live in denial. One of the things that just happened, because, you know, all the climate change stuff that you hear about is based on research from 2004 and before. But in 2006, in the summer, the North Polar ice melted 100 years ahead of what we thought was going to happen. This is a catastrophic event happened. Catastrophic. Right now, we are in a planetary emergency. But we are still pretty much unaware of that as a collective, and we certainly don't act on it. But let me share some of the information with you. So should we be worried? Yes. I'm sorry, it was the summer of 2007, not 2006. So this is the guy in the country who knows the most about this, James Hansen. This is the guy that Bush tried to gag so he couldn't speak to us and tell us how bad it was, even in scientific papers. He was head of NASA's Goddard Space Center, and he's an expert in ice. And he knows how important this was. Right now, the parts per million of carbon dioxide, anyone know? How many think it's 200 now? 300? 400? 500? Nobody's going to make a guess. It's 386, roughly, okay? It was 200 up until, you know, the Industrial Revolution, or 250. Hansen says that we have to get it to 350, that we have to get it lower than where we are now in order for there to be life as we like to know it on this planet. So that means we have to stop producing CO2 and we have to suck some out. We have to plant trees. Trees suck it out. If we keep going the way we are, we will have a disastrous level of sea rise. What will that be? Well, a meter, which is sort of the minimum projection, if we don't keep the temperature within 2 degrees, is going to flood most of lots of cities that we know. Certainly the San Francisco and Oakland and I think Sacramento Airport, but I know San Francisco and Oakland airports will be underwater. Miami will be underwater. Bangladesh. A lot of us like to live near the coast. But, of course, that's the smallest part of the problem when the sea level rises, because then it also contaminates the fresh water, and then you have less water to drink, and on and on. So this is the map of Florida with just a 1 meter rise. Al Gore, when he gave his speech winning the Nobel, this is what he said. We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization. So this is where we are today. And this is what we have to act on now. And what we need to do is really simple. And it's actually a lot of the things we need to do we already know how to do. We just don't have the political will to do it. We all think that the way to happiness is to go to the mall, because that's how we've been taught. But while we're sleeping, we're mortgaging away the future for the children. And what we simply need to do is stop our carbon economy and go to a low carbon economy. That's what we need to do, all of us. On your, they asked me for some references. I gave you this reference, Climate Code Red. I think it's the scariest thing to read. It's two Australian scientists who basically reviewed all the data and wrote maybe a 50 or a 60 page paper that I took some of this part of the talk from. And basically what they argue is that we are in an emergency now, and the response to it, in order to be successful, has to be on the level of the response that mobilized the U.S. during World War II. You know, General Motors, on a dime, stopped producing cars and started producing trucks and tanks for the military. That's the kind of worldwide, but certainly in this country, we need to lead mobilization that needs to happen over the next decade to change our path, our trajectory, so that we will have a future. And I would highly recommend that everybody read this and share it. You know, when you go home for Thanksgiving and nobody in the family really wants to hear what you have to say because you're the radical in the family and everybody's really just wants to talk about how their 401ks became 201ks, tell them it's worse than that. It's actually worse than that. But the thing is that we have a way out. There are ways out, and we'll talk about that in a little bit too. Winston Churchill, same kind of crisis, that World War II that I talked about, our mobilization. This is his famous quote, "The time for procrastination is over." Well, part of what we need to do, and to bring this back to the human rights question, part of what we need to do is we need to develop a new consciousness. All of us. We need to, in ourselves, we have to nurture it, and in our families, in our friends, in everybody, because we need to live a different way. And I didn't want to end on a depressing note. And I thought that, to bring it back to the human rights question, I thought that what Ecuador had decided to do with its recent constitution was somewhat instructive. And of course, a change in consciousness is just the beginning, because there has to be a change in behavior. But Ecuador basically said, we're going to enshrine this in our constitution. Here's Article 1 of their constitution, that nature has the right to exist and to regenerate. Article 2, it has the right to be restored. Article 3, that we have to protect nature and all the elements that form an ecosystem. Article 4, use the precautionary principle. Extinction of a species is something that's a final thing. You don't want to ever let that happen if you can avoid it. Right now, something like a quarter of the world's species are being threatened with extinction. we're in this time of the last time biodiversity was knocked back this far in terms of species extinction was 65 million years ago, to give you an idea. That's the time of the dinosaurs. And this last part of Article 4 really seems to deal with that question to me of genetic engineering. The introduction of organisms and organic and inorganic material that can alter in a definitive way the national genetic patrimony is prohibited. Do you know where corn comes from? It comes from Mexico. Do you know that Mexican corn is now, which is the original genetic stock of corn, is now contaminated with genetically modified corn? The professor who proved that at UC Berkeley was initially denied tenure for proving that and had to fight for it because there was a huge corporate pressure put on him. And here's Article 5, that we have the right to benefit from the environment and from natural wealth that will allow our well-being. So here we have an indigenous nation in the middle of the hemisphere beginning to address the kind of consciousness that we all need to address. I said that there are solutions. I just ran for political office in Richmond. I ran because I don't like the direction that things are going in. And I ran on a green economy platform. And we right now face this economic collapse because what did we do in our economy? We said, well, we don't really need to make anything here. That's really okay if everything gets made in China. All we have to do is bring it back here in ships and put it in the mall and we'll all buy it. And somehow that'll drive our economy. So now we have an economy where we don't make anything or we make very little things that we consume. We overconsume and we waste a tremendous amount of energy. At the same time that we've done that, we've made our wealth and our income the least equally shared since the Great Depression and maybe before. So that since 1965, the only piece of the American pie, the only group that actually had their slice of the pie got bigger was the top 20%. The bottom 80%, all the pieces got smaller. Over 40 years, people stagnated. If you ask yourself in a developed country, what is the most predictive thing for life expectancy, for longevity? It's income equality. When you're a poor country, you need money. Because you got to have a roof, you got to have clean water. Once you have all that stuff, there's no correlation between GDP and life expectancy. The countries where people live the longest are the countries where the social product is shared the most equally. So for 40 years now, we've done the opposite. We've created a billionaire class, and we have a middle class that's shrinking, and nobody even talks about the working class and the poor people anymore. At the same time, we have an ecological catastrophe. We have global warming. We can fix both problems at once. How many people have solar roof on their house here? Raise your hand. Nobody. You all will in 20 years. Who's going to put it there? This is our chance right now. What we're working on in Richmond is let's train our unemployed, let's train them in how to do solar, let's solar roof all our schools, let's put an investment in that. Schools are going to pay less for electricity in the future, 35% less forever in the future. So the way out of our twin problems right now is to build the only part of our economy that can grow, and that's the green economy. every house, business, office in this country needs to be weatherized. We got drafty houses, and inside we got chilly people, cold people, but it makes a hot planet, because to keep a room heated that's drafty and that's leaking out energy, we're turning the clock on producing that energy. So we literally need to weatherize every building in the country. We need to solarize every building in the country. You can't send that to China. You can't send the house to China, put the solar roof on, and bring it back. You can't outsource it. You don't need a college degree to do it. You need to know how to work with your hands. People can be trained to do this. We can turn this country around by being the greenest country. That's what we need to do. We're 3% of the population, and we're 25% of the energy use. We have to be able to export the clean technology to China and India instead of everybody starting to say, well, it's really the problem with the Chinese and the Indians. You already get the feeling that the U.S. is getting ready for a war with China in the future. That's where how this rhetoric goes. No, that's not what we need to do. We don't need Chinese people over there making our phony Christmas trees. We need them to green their world and green their economy, and we need to green ours here. So this is a plea to you, okay? I had to give a talk. That was the pretense to get in the door. But this is a plea to you. Our world is in trouble, and we're not going to solve these challenges by Barack Obama in the White House or me in the city council or one person here or one person there. This is going to change when we build a grassroots movement that everybody becomes part of, where we all figure out how to green our lives more, how to bring one more person in, how to explain this to our children, you know, how to deal with the fact that we can't live and waste like this and consume like this. California, we grow oranges, we export them at the same time we import oranges. Why do we do that? It makes no sense. We do it because it makes economic sense for the company to do it. We need to take responsibility for all of this life, and you are the ones who have a chance to really exert some of that leadership and make that happen. So this is a plea to you. Get involved. This is how you can reach me. That's my email. That's my website. Get on my website and put your name and address in, and we'll keep you posted on our newsletters and keep people informed about these things. But you have a sustainability group here at UCSF. You know, you have all kinds of things right here that we need to do. We need to change the way we grow food. We need to grow it locally. We need to grow it without pesticides. We need to dismantle industrial agriculture. We need you. We need all of you. It's not just about our individual lives anymore and how we're going to get our next foot forward. It's really about saving the planet, about saving the future for our children, for your children, for all of us. So really, this is a plea. I'm honored to be here. I hope I shared some things that are of interest to you. I'm totally interested in learning from you and hearing, you know, what you all have to say. So this is going to conclude my formal part. I'm going to sit down or stand up, but I'm very interested to hear how the world looks to all of you and you know, what you think we need to do and how my work and can help your work here. So thank you for your attention. Thank you. I mean, the war is costing a fortune. We're borrowing that. We're giving money to bankers. I think it's really where you put the money, and I think it really requires people who are making the decisions of where you put the money to have a different worldview and a different, you know, way of seeing things. I think it was really telling in the election when McCain attacked Obama for wanting to spread the wealth. And we live in a country which has become so unequal, yet he could attack him with that and even make Obama backpedal a little, but that's exactly what we need to do. You know, once you've made it so unequal, I mean, the obvious thing you have to do is to spread the wealth. But that's like a taboo to even talk about that. We've been so cowed by those who are in power, who have the money, who are pushing that agenda. And, you know, the well-to-do class in Sweden and Japan live longer than the well-to-do class in the U.S., partly because it's a more congenial society because things are shared more. And I recommend that all of you who are interested in this idea of income inequality and health become familiar with Michael Marmot's work, Marmot, and Richard Wilkinson, but particularly Michael Marmot, the status syndrome, and there's a whole area of epidemiology that didn't exist a generation ago called social epidemiology, which basically says that how long you live is less based on what your cholesterol is, your blood pressure. In fact, all these things together, everything that I spend my day doing is less important than your social status or even your perceived social status in determining how long you're going to live. So your cholesterol, whether you exercise, whether you have diabetes, your blood pressure, can't remember what, and your diet, all those things together are less, and smoking, are less predictive of how long you're going to live than your social class. It's also important to note that the cohesion, you know, in a society determines the people, they even use the word social capital, determines how long people live. If you look at the states in the United States and you rank them by income equality, you notice that the states that have the most income equality have the most civic trust. They trust each other the most. You know, there are these, you know, most people will take advantage of you, strongly agree, strongly disagree, that kind of question. So the states that share the income the most equally have the most trust, have the lowest homicide rates, have the best voter turnout, have the best payments to their welfare mothers, have the highest self-rated health scores, and volunteer for the most organizations. When we come together as a community and we build caring communities, we're healthier. And it's hard to do that when there are huge disparities in wealth and power, and which, you know, argues for, you know, building the middle. So if we're coming to the end, this has been great for me. It's really, you know, nice to be able to share ideas with people going to be leaders in the future. Write me your ideas, sign up on my website, and we'll let you know what we're doing in Richmond because it's all connected. If you don't know about the Green Festival, it's in San Francisco this weekend. There's way too many people there, but there's always a lot of interesting speakers. So I highly recommend that. And if you've never heard of the Bioneers, look at them up on the webpage. They have a great conference every year. You missed it this year in San Rafael, but it's a really great ecology conference. It's like Pioneers, but with a B, Bioneers. Check them out and go to San Rafael next October. You won't be disappointed.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.